Good morning, Breakfast Club.
Good morning.
My name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic. You know, when I was drinking, I was isolated in my house, cut myself off from everybody, just didn't want to have to deal with you people because you were difficult to deal with. And through the process of this program, I've gotten deeply interconnected with a lot of the people I see in this room. I see some people new in the program here who are on fire, and I love it. I know some people here who came through impossible odds, and they're sitting here today. They beat the odds. So many of you have beaten the odds. You're success stories, and I get to be deeply interconnected with you to really get to know you at a level. And I think it's through service that I've gotten to know some of the folks the best. Diane, she has survived several trips with me down to Macon. And her mind did not explode on that as we were going down. But we were going down there because, Diane, I think it was 2015 and 2016 that she served as the treasurer for Area 16. Now, I don't know if you know people who just don't do stuff halfway, you know, and Diane doesn't. She found a QuickBooks system that was not quite right and just couldn't stand that it was that way. And I know that she spent hundreds of hours straightening it out. And I want to give her applause for that. It says AA as such should never be organized, but the folk, the service organizations that make the 12-step work possible need to be organized, and she has done that. She is also the current co-chair of the Communications Committee, which is responsible for the website as well as the message that comes out that we get, and also for just the communications that go in general in Area 16. And so that's cool. So the other thing, she has two babies, and they've got four paws each, and loves them very much. And the other thing is she is a mean dollhouse maker. So there's so much. The beauty of getting to know each and every one of you is each and every one of you have these depths within you as well. And I could have missed it all, sitting there drinking, isolated in my home, and putting alcohol above all that. That's what keeps me sober. Come on up, Diane. You're in Kennesaw.
Thank you, Damon. And hi, everybody. My name is Diane, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, family. I am a pinch hitter, I hope you don't mind, for today, and I'm going to be very mindful of our time. I'm also very respectful of our fifth tradition. When I'm in an AA meeting, I do not talk about drugs. I limit my conversation to alcohol. Unfortunately, my story does include some drug use, and it has to be mentioned because it was the precursor to my alcohol, which brought me into these rooms. So I ask for your forgiveness in advance for having to mention it, but it is part of the story. I want to thank you all for letting me come out and tell my story today. Again, I am a pinch hitter, so I hope I'll meet your expectations. I'll qualify myself. My sobriety date is March 28th of 1988. So I will be, by the grace of God and fellowship of this program, hopefully I'll celebrate 30 years this coming March. Thanks, everyone. I'm very grateful and blessed to have been able to grow up in the program. And I wouldn't be here today had it not been for this program. I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a number of years ago, and we won't say how many. Whenever I was born with a genetic disease, and it's called, long word, epidermolysis bullosa. For short, they call it EB. A lot of people don't know this about me because I tend to hide it, but it's a significant part of my story. What it is, what the disease is I'm missing, there's a genetic mutation in my skin where my skin does not hold together. So friction, anything, I blister up, my skin comes off, my whole body is scarred. And most babies, it's very rare, there's only out of every 1 million babies born in the U.S., 20 of them may have this disease. And most babies do not survive because it affects the mucous membranes as well as the external skin. So any place where there's an epidural tissue, it's affected. And most babies don't live to see the age of two. I was very fortunate that I was able to survive and be here today. When I was born, my parents were advised by the hospitals to send me to a hospital to be in a padded crib and let to die. Fortunately, I am going to tear up. Fortunately, my parents said no, they were going to raise me and they were going to try to do their very best. And they decided that they were going to raise me so that I could be as normal as possible. And they may have taken it to the other extreme. Yeah. So, I have somebody in my family who has cerebral palsy, and she was raised to be very dependent on her parents, dependent on other people. To this day, she's dependent. And my parents decided they did not want me to be dependent. They wanted me to be independent. They wanted me to survive, and they wanted me to be strong. And they wanted me to be self-sufficient. And they succeeded in that. The only part of my body that did not blister was my bottom side, my little butt, yeah. And they took advantage of that quite frequently. I did have one older sibling at the time, and, you know, little things that would happen, I would get the spanking, okay? Because, of course, they wanted me to be strong and independent, and so I was disciplined quite often. I'll back up. One of the things that happened to me, because this is part of my sober story, one of the things that happened when I was two, right before I turned two, I had developed a significant infection in my ankle. And I was scheduled to have my leg amputated. And this was still up in Pittsburgh. And my family went to the, stayed up all night in the chapel, and they prayed. And when they took the bandages off to prep me for surgery for the amputation, it was healed. Now, does that mean, well, not completely healed, the infection was completely gone, but I was scheduled for an amputation. Does that mean that it was a miracle? I want to believe that it was. Could it have been that I was on different antibiotics when I got to the hospital? Who knows? But to this day, I still believe that that was a miracle. Blood poisoning 13 times. I grew up on crutches. I grew up in slings. I grew up bandaged from my shoulders to my fingers and from my hips to my toes. And when I was younger, the one thing I associated with my mom was pain. Because when you have to unbandage and rebandage, it's very painful. So I associated people with pain. That led to my isms. People are dangerous. People can't be trusted. People hurt. I'm going to tear up. Give me a minute. My older sibling, since my mom had to spend all of her time keeping me alive, my older sibling, thank you so much, my older sibling didn't get a lot of her time, so my mom would take her off to places like stores and do fun things, and I would be left at home. Well, as a kid, you don't understand that the reason is because all of her time was spent with me, keeping me alive. All I saw was that my mom preferred my older sibling, because that's who all the fun things were done with. And one of the things that I did learn over time is that my mom was very resentful of me because I basically cost her life. She had to spend all of her time keeping me alive, at least the first 5 years, until I learned how to take care of myself and bandage myself. She frequently told me that I was the black sheep of the family. And when I got older, she actually encouraged me to have a hysterectomy, because the worst thing that you can do is to have kids. I took those things to heart. Whether they were meant or not, the way that they were said is irrelevant, because I took them to heart. When I was in nursery school, one of the kids came up to me and said, "I'm not allowed to play with you. You have to stay away." And I asked them why. And they said, "Because my mom said you had leprosy." I didn't know what that was. I went home and I asked my mom, "What is leprosy?" She told me. That hurt. It hurt very badly. All of this led into my feelings of being terminally unique. We all go through different things, but what I've found is most of us, when we get into these rooms, we have these feelings of being terminally unique for whatever reason. And these are the things that led to me feeling terminally unique. I was being shunned as a kid. People would point at me. They would. Well, you can imagine what it was like growing up like that. When I was in going into third grade in the public school system, the teachers decided that they were going to put me in the special needs, the retarded class. Because I had to carry a first aid kit with me. I'd bump into desks, blister up, I'd have to go to the bathroom, bandage myself. And the teachers didn't want to have to deal with it. Now, the problem with that is that when I was five, you know how when you're in kindergarten, before you start school, they always give you these IQ tests, right? I don't know how accurate those are, but I came out at this genius level. And my parents said, "There's no way my child is going to be in a retarded class." So they had to spend money to send me to a private school, a Catholic school, so that I could be in a normal class and learn normally and not end up in the special needs classes. That was yet another financial burden on my family. My family was already financially burdened just keeping me alive, with all the medical expenses, the bandages, etc. That was yet another resentment from my family towards me. I am a thoroughbred alcoholic. My dad was a practicing alcoholic. He came from a long line of alcoholics. My mom was an untreated Al-Anon. She wasn't an alcoholic herself, but she grew up in an alcoholic home. And she had all the isms of the untreated untreated Al-Anon, very narcissistic, a little psychotic, still is. And I used to be terrified of my father. He ended up having to take a job where he traveled all the time to help support me, to keep me alive. Another resentment from my mother. He was home only 2 weeks out of the year. And when he was home, our whole lives had to change because, you know, you can't tell Daddy anything. You can't let Daddy know what's going on. You can't. We had to be walking on eggshells. And my dad, being the practicing alcoholic, he would go into these alcoholic rages at times. He put fists through walls. He put chairs through walls. He was a raging alcoholic. And I remember laying in bed thinking, I am so scared of this man because I know at any minute he could just break my neck, you know? Not that he would, but those are the fears that as a child I went through. But the other side of that was that my dad preferred me over my siblings because I was like him. I was the son he never had. I was, believe it or not, the tomboy. I've got all the scars to prove it. I was the tomboy. I was the one who wanted to learn how to do things, and he would teach me how to do things, and I was his favorite. And the only time that I truly felt loved in that household was when my dad was at home. So on one side, the only real love that I ever experienced was from my father. But on the other side, I was terrified of him. And that was really hard for me initially to grasp, to understand, to get past. My dad did eventually die from this disease. And it was difficult to see him go, even though he did scare me. Going through high school, I learned when I was 12, I started to work. Because of the financial situation, I always had to wear my sister's hand-me-downs. My sister's much larger than me. Well, I couldn't take her hand-me-downs anymore because I couldn't fit into the hand-me-downs. So I started working, doing yard work, digging ditches, cleaning out gutters, cutting grass when I was 12 years old to make money so that I could buy my own clothes to wear because I wanted my own brand new pair of blue jeans. Well, that became an addiction for me. I learned that if I'm out there working, I don't have to be home. And I did not like to be home because it was a very dysfunctional, sick environment. And I never felt accepted, I never felt loved, I never felt good in the home. So I started working like that. By the time I was 16, going into high school, my junior year of high school, I became the youngest first manager of a movie theater. I was working full-time, salaried employee. 6 months into my senior year, I came home late from work one night, and I still needed to do my homework and get up and go to school the next day. And my dad was there, and he was intoxicated. And my dad loved to argue when he was drunk. He always liked to pick that fight, you know? He wanted somebody to argue with. And this night, I was tired. I wanted to get my homework done. I wanted to go to bed. And I just sat there, and I listened to him, and I wouldn't bite. I would not fight with him this night. I would not argue. He ended up picking me up from my neck. He threw me across the kitchen. I slid down the kitchen door. When he went to bed, I packed my bags and I left my house. I got my own apartment. I hadn't even graduated from high school yet. And I became self-sufficient and I got out of the sick environment. But I also started to work, and it became an addiction. When I was 9, they diagnosed me with epilepsy, yet one more thing to make me terminally unique. And the form of epilepsy that I had was absence. They call it now absence seizures. Back then, it was petit mal seizures. And what I went through was after a seizure, I would get these severe migraine headaches. And they started treating me with a lot of, this is the drug part of my story, a lot of narcotics to get rid of the migraines. I used to have an open prescription at the hospital in the emergency room for Demerol shots. When the regular medications, the regular narcotics wouldn't work, I would go get a Demerol shot, get knocked out for a day. That kept going until I was 20. I learned that, and I was a few years sober before I learned I did this, if I was facing something that was stressful or I didn't want to do it or I felt insecure about it, I could bring on a migraine so that I could justify taking the narcotic to get out of doing it. I learned how to escape from life at a very young age using something outside of myself. I learned that, and I was this good little Catholic girl. I was a cradle Catholic, and I couldn't take, you know, I couldn't do it unless it was prescribed, right? So I would bring on those migraines to get out of doing things. After I went through high school, I floated through high school. I don't remember high school because of the medications, because by the time I got to high school, I wanted to escape from everything, you know? I could not live in my own skin at this point. I had all these low self-esteem issues. I had all these fear of people issues. I had all the isms that we bring into this program were already instilled in me, and they were very deeply ingrained at this point. When I ended up moving out of the house and I was in college, I ended up starting college early before I graduated from high school and started to date, believe it or not. And at one point, I ended up becoming engaged to a man, and this was when I was 21. I need to back up a minute. Right before that, I had a back injury at work, and I was flat on my back for like 3 months. And they treated that with a lot of narcotics. And I got to the point to where I found that I really liked the Valium, and I had to have it. And that scared me because I was afraid of addiction. So I decided that vodka could be used in lieu of the Valium, and I successfully detoxed myself off of the Valium using vodka, and vodka became my drink of choice. So instead of taking Valium every day, I started to drink every day. And that is the moment when I crossed that fine line into alcoholism. That's when I was no longer a social drinker. I was a full-blown alcoholic, because I had to have that vodka every night. I had to have it to escape. I had to have it to live in my own skin. I had to have it to shut my head off so I could sleep. I had to have it. And then I became engaged. There was a lot of alcohol involved in this relationship. And at one point, he put his fist through my wall because he got angry. And of course, it brought back all those memories of my father. And if you haven't heard this before, you know, they tell us that like attracts like. So as sick as I was attracting very sick. And I broke off the engagement because he terrified me. I did not want to end up living in the life that I had as a child. And he didn't really want to accept that. A few months later, we met. I brought friends along. It was at a bar. We got intoxicated, the friends left, and he decided that if he couldn't have me, what he said, if he couldn't have me, nobody else would, and I struggled with him for 2 hours with a shotgun pointed at my head. That was my first bottom. I ended up being able to get back to my car. I convinced him that we could make the relationship work. I got him to bring me back to my car. I drove like you've never seen somebody drive before, honking my horn, trying to attract police, anything to get out of this situation. After that, I did end up moving back, or went to my parents' house as a safety, because where I was living, I was scared that he would come back. And it's the first time I'd been back to my parents' house since I moved out when I was in high school. And it was very difficult for me to do that, but I knew it was safer. And while I was there, I didn't drink, because I already knew after that night that I was an alcoholic, and it terrified me because I was becoming, or had become, my father. after 3 days of being there, I knew I needed help. And I could not ask my parents for help. I didn't know how to ask my parents for help because I wasn't 100% sure what was really going on. But I knew I needed help. And I was in my bedroom, and I sat there with the razor blade and a little tin bowl and waited for my mom to come in to say goodnight and feigned a suicide attempt to try to get help. That was the only thing I knew to do because I thought if I just asked for it, they would say something like, "You don't need that. You don't. They had to see how desperate I'd become. And they did take me to Bronner's, which in those days was the counterpart to Ridgeview. And when I went in, since I'd been at my parents' for 3 days, I didn't have alcohol in my system. When I went in, I told them, no matter what, when I get out of here, I don't want to drink again. And they did all the tests and everything, and the doctor said, "You're not an alcoholic, you're just depressed." And I said, "Oh, okay." So they put me... They put me at Bronner's. They called it the big house, okay? It was really a locked up series of rooms with a few padded cells along the way. And they put me in the big house for 30 days for a depression, you know? And they started treating the depression. And yeah, I was depressed. I mean, who's not going to be depressed if they're an acting alcoholic? About a week before, or shortly before I was supposed to be discharged, they sent me down to the recovery center at Bronner's to be with the family members of the alcoholic that was in treatment, and they learned all about Al-Anon, all about the disease, and I came back to the doctor afterwards and told him all the stuff I learned. And he said, "Huh, maybe you're an alcoholic after all." So then they sent me for 30 days down to the recovery center to learn more about how to not drink and live sober. And I knew whenever I was leaving there, I said, you know, I never want to drink again. I never want to drink again. And I really believed I never wanted to drink again. But I started going to meetings where I was listening to a lot of drunkalogs. And in those drunkalogs, I was listening to people who had the DUIs. They lost the jobs. They lost. That hadn't happened to me yet because my drinking career at that point was only a year and a half deep daily, but it was only a year and a half. I was still a successful person working, supporting myself, doing everything else except I had to have that drink at night. And those tapes started to play in my head about what the doctor said, that maybe you're not an alcoholic, you're just depressed. I stopped going to meetings because I chose not to relate. I chose to compare my externals to their externals instead of my internal to their internal. If we stop going to meetings, it's only a matter of time before we relapse. And 4 days before my 90-day chip, I relapsed. And I drank another 9 months before I hit the next bottom. You would think having a shotgun pointed at your head would be enough of a bottom, but for me, not so much. I had to hit the emotional bottom. The emotional bottom that said that I was at the point to where I either needed to end my life or go to AA because I was that miserable. I could not drink. I didn't even go through the stage of trying to not drink because I couldn't do it. I had to have my alcohol on a daily basis. On Sundays, when we had the blue laws, you couldn't buy alcohol on Sundays back then. I would drive from Marietta to Villa Rica, where I could buy the alcohol and then drive back home. Of course, the alcohol would be drunk by the time I got back home, but I would drive back home. And, you know, if a non-alcoholic doesn't do that. And I knew the moment that I had relapsed, I had the shot of vodka, I knew at that moment that I was in fact an alcoholic because halfway through that first drink, I was already thinking of the second. And it squashed every idea that had been going through my head about maybe I wasn't an alcoholic. And you know what we say, a head full of AA and a belly full of booze doesn't mix. And those are the, when I was in my relapse, those were the most miserable 9 months I think I had in my life because I knew better. But the guilt, shame, and remorse of the relapse kept me out there. And I did have to hit another emotional bottom to get past the ego and be willing to walk back in these rooms. And I was afraid that, you know, the people that supported me so well, that they wouldn't welcome me back, that they would judge me. What I found when I walked back in these rooms was that I was loved. I was accepted. And it washed all those fears away. The guilt, the shame, and remorse that kept me from coming back into these rooms initially was gone. I was welcomed with open arms. And I always say that I'm glad that I did have that relapse, because at some point those tapes would have kept coming up. When I got sober, I got a sponsor, a true Southern belle. She used to say things to me like, "Sugar, never forget your last drunk." And then she'd say, "Sugar, the further away you get from your last drunk, the closer you get to your next one." And then she'd say, "Sugar, if you're not the problem, there ain't no solution." And those were some of the things that I took to heart when I got sober. She also said that this program does not tell me that life is going to be a bed of roses. It tells me that I'm going to be given a set of tools. I'm going to be given a toolbox that I can use to deal with life on life's terms, because I couldn't deal with life on life's terms when I came into these rooms. My first year, I remember, there's not much I remember about my first year except that I would sit in the back of the room and I would cry. My first year I spent crying in the back of the room. When I picked up my first year chip, and I don't agree with this, but when I picked up my first year chip, some of the guys in the meeting had taken a bet about whether or not I was going to make it through that first year. They told me about it afterwards, and yeah, we shouldn't do those things. But I did make it through that first year, and I made it through the second and the third. And I made it by working these steps and staying close to the program. When I was 5 years sober, I ended up losing my higher power. And this is a big part of my story. You know, I said earlier that I was a cradle Catholic. I also told you about at least one of the miracles that had happened in my life. And I had always carried that through when I was working steps 2 and 3. I had that faith in a higher power, and I knew that if I sought him, he would restore me to sanity, like it says in step 2. And I knew that if I turned my life and my will over to him, my life would be better, as it says in step 3. When I was 5 years sober, I started getting into these debates with people about religion and God. And what I found was that I couldn't defend my faith, my belief. I had a few miracles that had happened, but that was it. I was a cradle Catholic. I was told that God existed. I was taught that there were books about it. I was taught, but you know what? I was taught the same thing about Santa Claus. I woke up one day to find out that Santa Claus didn't exist. In 5 years sober, I woke up and said, "I wonder if God really exists," because I couldn't defend it. It was all on faith. And so I had to do a lot of research, and that was probably the darkest point in my sobriety, was when I woke up and had lost my faith. I started doing a lot of research, as I said, and started going to all these different religious groups, and I did everything. It took me almost 2 years to redevelop a faith. It started out by being an agnostic, where I said, okay, there's something, I just don't know what. A lot of us, when we walk in these rooms, we don't know what our higher power is. But if we can at least grasp onto the fact that there's something, I just don't know what, it can save our ass. And that's what I had to do. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that there was something. And then I was able to further develop my spirituality and get back on track, but it took, like I said, a couple of years. And now I'm back to being Catholic. But, you know, it was difficult. And it enables me to relate to people who walk in these rooms that don't have a higher power. It allows me to not judge people. It allows me to let people that I sponsor to develop their own higher power. I'll share about what mine is if somebody asks, but I don't force it. I let people develop their own, because if we don't, we're not going to have what it needs to save our backside when the chips are down. When I did my fourth step, I learned that all of those isms that I talked about that were developed when I was growing up, they were all fear-based. My fourth step came out as I was afraid of my own shadow. Most of my character defects, the things I had to make amends for in 9, were all things pertaining to omission as opposed to commission. Since my drinking career was short, and I spent all of my time working, staying away from people, isolating. I mean, I drank at home. I didn't go to bars. I didn't party. I isolated. I stayed away from people. Those were the amends that I had to make, and I had to continue to make for the rest of my life, living amends to my family, to those people around me, because most of what I did was I pushed people away. I pushed my family away. I pushed everyone away. So those amends for me, while I did say my I'm sorries, I had to do the living amends and become a different person. I had to get past my fears. I had to accept the fact that things happened. I had to accept me and be able to live in my own skin. I had to become different. And the only way to become different was to work the steps all the way through and to continue to work the steps and live the steps in my life. Today, the steps they're so ingrained in me since I grew up in this program that I try to live the steps. And I was also one of those people when I first got sober, it's like traditions. What's the big deal about traditions? You know, you use the steps to stay sober. My home group had a 12 and 12 on Saturday nights. The last Saturday of the month was a tradition study. And of course, that was the meeting I always missed, because traditions, what's the big deal about traditions? So I'm disappointed in myself, but you know, it's stuff happens. I was several years sober before I really started looking at the traditions. And the traditions play a vital part in the fact that this program is still here today and was here the day that I needed it. And without our traditions, the AA is not going to be around for the future alcoholic. So the traditions are critical for us to ensure that AA is there for the suffering alcoholic in the future. They're also critical for us if we apply them in our own lives to be able to be happy, joyous, and free along with our steps. So the traditions are critical for us. And like I said, I was several years sober before I actually started to look at those traditions. And at the point that I started looking at the traditions, I realized that service work is very important. While my sponsor always told me to stay centered in the program if you want continued sobriety, she used to tell me, well, back then, clean out the ashtrays, you know. She used to tell me, it's the Christmas party, you will bring something. She would tell me all these things that I needed to do to be of service. But I didn't really understand service work until I understood the traditions. And then I started to get involved in the group. You know, until then, the meeting was there. You know, I cleaned out ashtrays, I made coffee, but I didn't really understand the workings of a group and how important it is to make sure that the meeting actually does get set up, that we pay rent, you know. Go figure, we have to pay rent. We have to pay, in some cases, utilities. You know, I never thought about those things until I started looking at the traditions. And you know, I started out by being the greeter, And then I moved on to being a secretary, a treasurer, alternate GSR, GSR, multiple times over. And eventually, I was asked to stand for the state treasurer's position, which I did. And as Damon mentioned, and I loved being of service. You know, I was able to go back to school in the program, and I put myself through college, 5 years sober. I became a CPA, so a certified public accountant, and I've had a successful career. But none of that matters. What matters is the fact that God gave me some gifts. He gave me some challenges, mind you, but He gave me some gifts. And it's my responsibility to use those God-given gifts to help further AA and ensure that it's here for the suffering alcoholic in the future. And when I hear that the need exists, as my sponsor always told me, you suit up and you show up. When I received a call yesterday with the last-minute cancellation, I didn't say no. I suited up and I showed up. When the communications co-chair resigned 6 months before they were supposed to rotate into the communications chair, no one else reached out. I suited up and I showed up. That's my responsibility, to be of service and to give back what has so freely been given to me. And that keeps me centered in this program, and it keeps me sober on a daily basis. With that, I'll close, and thank you so much for letting me tell my story.